pitched the ball to Bell. That's up field. 40, 45, 50, 45, 40. He's in the 30, 20, 10, 5. Touchdown, Cowboys. What a run.
Kicks it left wing, Lucas. Three-point jumper. Good. 6 seconds. No! Rebound! Cowboys win! Cowboys win! Oh, the Cowboys are going to the Final Four!
Pistols firing! Touchdown, Oklahoma State!
Okay, David Ubben, Big 12 blogger, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, how you doing?
Pretty good. We got football just around the corner. What are we, about 4.5 weeks away? You getting excited?
I am. Excited to watch some football. Maybe not too excited for the long days, but it's always fun.
Yeah, it's going to be a fun year, as it always is. Some unexpected stuff will undoubtedly take place. I wanted to kind of tell the listeners a little bit about your background, kind of how you got to where you are at ESPN as the Big 12 blogger. So why don't you tell the listeners out there how you got there?
Well, I think it goes back really to high school. I played some basketball in high school, but quit after sophomore year. And so I thought, now that the NBA dream was slowly dying, I figured I should have some sort of backup plan. So I started covering some high school games in small towns in Arkansas where I lived for the Benton County Daily Record, a very small paper that I think does not exist anymore. And then shortly after that, I went to the Morning News of Northwest Arkansas, where I covered junior high football, 8 junior highs in Northwest Arkansas. I did some high school stuff on Friday night and some desk stuff during the week. And then I went to Missouri for college. I didn't really do a whole lot the first 2 years of college. I kind of just focused on school. But then I started working for the Columbia Missourian and covered some Columbia College basketball, NAIA. I love that team. That was some fun. It was a lot more fun than it sounded. And then covered Missouri in 2008, the last year of the Chase Daniel era. And then interned for the Oklahoman, covered Oklahoma football the last year of the Sam Bradford era, which went just fine for the Sooners. And then covered some Oklahoma basketball that year, and then left and joined ESPN in March of 2010. So it's kind of been a little bit of a quick ride. I realized that this job, I've been at it now a little over 17 months, and this is the longest that I've ever held a job, so that's good.
Wow. Well, kind of along the way, you pick up the, you know, you go to Missouri, you work for the Oklahoman, and so people think that you pick up these biases towards certain teams, but it's really kind of the opposite, isn't it?
Yeah, to some degree. I don't know that it's necessarily the opposite, but I think some people I think any fan of a team would love to necessarily, you know, kind of cover that team. And I think some people kind of assume that the people that cover these teams are fans of that team. I don't think it could have been any further from the truth for myself. I mean, I was from Arkansas. I grew up there. I didn't know really Missouri from Adam, you know, until I started going to school there. And, you know, as an out-of-state student, I didn't necessarily, you know, get too emotionally involved in the sports. And then, you know, Oklahoma, that came out of nowhere. And I kind of just ended up there one summer and then, you know, started covering Oklahoma at the end of that summer. And so, you know, obviously I kind of kept track of Oklahoma going to a Big 12 school, but definitely not, you know, I didn't grow up watching them and all that stuff. I mean, I definitely grew up watching the SEC. So in terms of, you know, early 90s type stuff, you're going to lose me a little bit on Big 12 history, stuff that I haven't necessarily read about, but I grew up watching the SEC.
Yeah. Well, I do want to talk about the Big 12, specifically Oklahoma State a little bit. You just came out with kind of a, and this, I thought this was pretty cool. You came out with an overview of your positional rankings,
mm-hmm.
And kind of tallied them up. And obviously OU came out on top, OSU and A&M were right behind them. Where would you say was the biggest gap between number one and number two, as far as what position was there the biggest gap at?
I think definitely running back. I mean, you look at what A&M has. I mean, it's unbelievable. Those guys, you know, they've got two basically established running backs. You know, a guy that ran for 1,000 yards last year in Cyrus Gray, a guy that should have ran for 1,000 yards last year, Christian Michael, and a guy that, you know, same Christian Michael, freshman of the year in 2009 when he rushed for almost 900 yards. And they just got, you know, so much experience at that position, so much physical skill. You know, obviously there's a lot of potential, you know, from guys at Oklahoma, Oklahoma State, Kansas State as well, Bryce Brown. But what Texas A&M has, the combination of talent and experience, the gap just looks really big at a pretty weak position for the Big 12. I mean, you take A&M away, that's looking pretty grim for everyone else in the Big 12 in terms of you know, what they're bringing back. And so I think there's definitely a huge gap there.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you've got a guy for OSU and just Frandl, who hasn't even rushed for 500 yards in a season yet, and you've got OSU with the third best running backs in the Big 12. So that kind of goes to show what, you know, just how thin that position really is.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of potential with some of those guys. And obviously Randall comes up, you know, Roy Finch and Brendan Clay and Brandon Williams, those guys at Oklahoma. But outside of that, you know, James Sims was a little bit more impressive than I think he gets credit for, you know, playing on a Kansas team that just simply couldn't throw the ball. Teams stacked up against him, and he still ran for almost 800 yards. So he's definitely a guy that's a little underrated coming into the year.
When you're throwing five passes against Texas and beating them, that's not a good thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking of A&M, they're going to allegedly be ranked in the top 10, 12, 15. Do we believe in them? And if we do, what's kind of one thing that I've not really seen one thing that they're excellent at?
Oh, I think running the ball. Their offensive line, you know, the numbers did not look good for them last year. They gave up, you know, something like 39 sacks. It was like 104th in the country. You know, the numbers weren't necessarily great, but you watch them play. I mean, you look at that game against Nebraska last year. You look at the game against Oklahoma. I mean, they were winning the line of scrimmage in those games. They were running the ball consistently. And I think, it could just be a situation where they had so many young tackles last year. You know, Jake Matthews and Luke Jokel, two guys that were freshmen. And I think when you have those two young guys on the bookends, your pass blocking definitely can suffer. I don't know that that's necessarily the number one thing, but they had a lot of experience inside. They lose Matt Allen, their center, this year. But I think, you know, they really, really did have a lot of success running the ball. I think that's pretty obvious, you know, especially late in the year against a defensive line. You know, in Texas and Oklahoma and Nebraska, all three of those I thought were pretty good. And then you look what they did against LSU. Obviously not happy with their effort, but they still ran the ball pretty well. Cyrus Gray hit 100 yards. And so I think if you want to look for one thing they do best, you know, I think definitely you got to like their chances in the red zone, throwing it up to Fuller. But number one is definitely running the ball between an offensive line that I thought the second half of the season got really, really, really improved and really going to be a team that's going to be tough to stop the run because of that offensive line that's going to continue that, I think, and because they have so many running backs. I mean, you look at Michael and Gray, and it's easy to talk to those guys, but you got, you know, Ben Molina and Mr. Jones behind them that are extremely underrated, and if they had a chance elsewhere, could really make some noise.
Yeah, and they do have a pretty easy schedule. Their biggest road games are, I guess, at OU and at Texas Tech, so it's kind of one of those situations where, you know, they can get inside Kyle Field and get a lead and let their defense handle things and kind of just milk it as far as running the ball. So I guess I could see that. I don't know if I'm completely bought into them yet. But
yeah, it'll be interesting. I think, too, you know, Mike Sherman was talking about how he thinks his defense is going to be better this year without Michael Hodges and Von Miller. I'm not entirely sold on that, but I do think it's possible. You know, I think people want to look at Von Miller leaving, but I've said this all along. I think a much bigger loss for them is going to be Michael Hodges because they don't have anyone left to step in and fill his role. I mean, he was our leading tackler last year, and I think even Mike Sherman admits you're not going to replace the talent and athleticism of a guy like Von Miller. But they do have a guy in DeMontre Moore, that joker, that can play that kind of position that did well when Miller was hurt last year. But a middle linebacker, you know, next to Garrick Williams, they just don't have a guy that you really feel confident in. Kyle Mangan did not play well in the Cotton Bowl. LSU really gashed them. They may be left to leave it to a true freshman, Donnie Bags. Jonathan Stewart's going to be in the mix, too, for them. But if you're starting a true freshman at a middle linebacker spot, obviously you've got to be impressed with his physical talent to come in. But replacing some of the experience, you know, like a guy like Hodges had, a former walk-on, it's going to be tough for them.
Jonathan Stewart, I think he was on my fantasy football team last year.
I think so. I'm sure. I'm sure he was not good with D'Angelo Williams getting it done. But you know, Saturdays at Cal Field, Sundays in Carolina. You got to like it.
You're talking about defense and how important it is in the Big 12, specifically for A&M. And it's one thing that OSU, Oklahoma State, has really struggled with recently, specifically defensive line.
Mm-hmm.
In your opinion, what's the best way to build kind of a top-tier defensive line?
Well, number one, I mean, Tommy Tuberville's really stressed this over at Tech. You've got to have pass rushers. And it's not about getting sacks or putting up big numbers like Von Miller had the last couple of years. It's just about pressuring the quarterback, making him go through his reads, making him uncomfortable, making him move, and just making him not be able to just sit back there and pick you apart. You know, Kansas obviously had tons of problems, but I think they had something like 11 sacks last year, which was around definitely outside of the top 100. And you want to look at a way you want to improve your team. That's a great place to start, because it can mask so many other problems if you have a great pass rush. Obviously, you have to watch out for the screen game, and teams can take that away. But if you can get some pressure up front with four guys, I mean. You look at, I think a good example of that is the Texas Tech game last year. People forget Texas went to Lubbock and won to move to 3-0 last year before the wheels fell off.
Yeah.
It's, you look back at that and you look at the end of the year, and you're like, how did that happen? Well, they had a ton of really healthy offensive linemen. Jackson Jeffcoat blew up that game. He was all over the place. And Jackson didn't necessarily get a chance to really make good on his year. He had a high ankle sprain that really, limited what he could do the rest of the year, but all Texas did was just throw four guys at Tech's offensive line, which was pretty experienced last year, and they couldn't do anything. You know, they're moving the quarterback around, but they had, you know, obviously those three NFL corners in the back, and the Texas offense just couldn't do anything against them. And you know, if Texas's front four stays healthy, you know, you never know how many other games they might have won. Obviously, they had tons of problems elsewhere, but you know, if you can get a pass rush up front, and it only takes you four or five guys to do it, you're going to be in great shape. But you got to have pass rushers for sure in the Big 12.
Well, OSU's kind of, you know, they've kind of gone in the past and this year to the junior college route to try to bring in some defensive linemen. Do you think that's something that, I mean, is that kind of like a stopgap? Do you need to really get those guys in as freshmen to develop them? Or do you think junior college is an okay way to go?
It's different for every program. It kind of depends on your needs right then. You know, sometimes you get a guy and he doesn't necessarily turn out. Sometimes you get a guy and he blows up. I mean, teams do it, you know, in a lot of different ways. I think ideally you'd want to get a freshman. You can come in there and, you know, learn behind some guys, or refine his technique. Probably needs to you know, gain a little bit of weight and maybe get a little faster. But you look at what Missouri's done on the defensive line. I mean, they had very little to note. You know, they had some good pass rushers back in the day, Stryker, Sulak, those types of guys. But what they have right now on the defensive line is unbelievable, and they've done that without any JUCO guys. They've got a former offensive lineman who's morphed into the best pass rusher in the Big 12 heading into 2011 in Brad Madison. And then they've got, you know, Jaquise Smith, who's entering his fourth year, being a major contributor for that offense, or for the defense. And then Dominique Hamilton and Terrell Rossano in the middle. And then obviously, you know, Sheldon Richardson, who all Missouri fans would love to see on campus, you know, a former, you know, top flight recruit, a blue chip guy out of St. Louis. Who knows whether or not he's going to be on campus for sure this fall. But, you know, he could be a game changer. But really, they've just built their defensive line from high schools. And I think that's definitely the easiest way to do it.
Who is the best or who in the Big 12 right now is going to turn out to be the best pro football player?
It's an interesting question. I think definitely, you know, it's hard to imagine Justin Blackmon going to the NFL and not having success. He just does everything so well. And I think he's going to get a lot better at getting a feel for space and then running routes in the NFL. And to have huge success, I think you'll have to. Landry Jones probably up there. I like Cyrus Gray's chances just because he has such a low center of gravity, but he runs with a nice balance of power and speed, and he's really shifty in tight spaces, which can pay off in the NFL. Kelechi Osemele over at Iowa State doesn't get a lot of pub, but I think he's got a great chance to be a really good NFL player. And I think those are the guys that really kind of jump out to you. You just don't see a whole lot of bust at left tackle. And I like that. I'd say Blackmon, Landry Jones, Kelechi Osemele, and Cyrus Gray. I think I'd go with those four guys.
Well, talking about Landry Jones, you mentioned in your quarterback rankings, you ranked Whedon ahead of him, but you said you thought Landry would have the better year. Mm-hmm. Why is that?
I think he's got a deeper receiving core. I think that might change at Oklahoma State if Hubert Anium can become a big player for them. I think, you know, Landry just has a lot more room to get better, I think. I don't think he was really playing his best football last year until, late in the season when you saw Oklahoma start to kind of win games on the road and play like themselves on the road. You know, he just completely self-destructed in the fourth quarter against Missouri. The first half against Texas A&M, he didn't look like himself. And I thought Whedon, you know, for the most part, was really consistent all of last year. He didn't have any games where you were just kind of like, you know, what happened there? Right. the first half against A&M was a little rough for him, but he was getting pressured then. I think like he'd never had in his entire career. I think Jones, you've just seen a natural progression. He's gotten so much better as his career has gone on, and I think even in the middle of last year, you saw so much improvement. Which, you know, he didn't necessarily see from Whedon. And that's, you know, nothing to take away from Whedon, but he was just he was solid all year and obviously put together some crazy numbers. But I think the upside for Jones is bigger. And I think this year, now that he's comfortable, he knows his role on this team, he knows what he has to do to be better. He's got a lot more experience than Whedon as well. I think his upside is a lot bigger.
Well, it's kind of funny because, you look at last year, and Landry Jones was great, not to take anything away from him, but I didn't really feel like he was at the level of even a Jason White or like a Bradford like they've had in the past. And mm-hmm. yet, the other day I read a little post by Barry Trammell talking about how he's well within striking distance of every career OU record ever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I think that really does speak to, you know, the – how good he's been, and yet the upside that he still has.
I think so. And it helps to be on the field as much as he was. I mean, you look at the records Colt McCoy put up. He's a four-year starter.
Right.
Landry's not necessarily a full four-year starter. He had 10 starts as a freshman in 2009. But definitely, I mean, he had some rough games. Obviously, that Nebraska 5-interception game was probably his lowest moment. But for the most part, he's been solid, and especially when – you know, they've played lower tier competition. He's put up some nice numbers. And so, you know, just simply having a chance to be on the field, you know, at Oklahoma, not a lot of guys get an opportunity to start for 4 years. And Landry, you know, he's going to get that opportunity if he wants it next year. I mean, he'll only be a junior this year, but we'll see what happens at the end of this year.
Well, we're kind of in this era, I guess you could say, of sports statistics, where you've had your sabermetrics take over in baseball, and I think to a degree take over a little bit in basketball. And I feel like we haven't really experienced that in football yet. How much do you get into in-depth football stats?
I'm not a huge sabermetrics guy. You know, I don't like math. That's why I got into journalism. But, you know, that's the other thing. You know, there's about 50 different acronyms for baseball, and I don't really like baseball as much either. So, you know, I definitely, you know, understand that there's a lot of merit to that stuff. And I'm interested when I see it. But honestly, you know, some of the really advanced statistics, you have to kind of sit down and understand them and get down to knowing exactly what – you know, these are measuring, and I think the ones that have had some staying power are definitely interesting, but, you know, it's a little bit difficult when you have to, you know, go hunt for them too. There's not a lot that are easily, like, you can just click them up, you know, whenever you need them. You kind of have to do a lot, and I think, you know, our ESPN stats and info people are great, you know, if we want something, like, exact. Like, you know, I did a post earlier this year looking at Landry Jones's, you know, short passes. Unfortunately, Oklahoma State had a couple games that weren't televised. They couldn't get all of Whedon's stats. Mm-hmm. But Oklahoma, I mean, just ask them and they can look up, you know, every single short pass that he had and chart it all out, which that helps. And I definitely like, you know, some of the, you know, advanced efficiency and all of those things. But, you know, it's tough to get stats that you can't readily compute yourself.
Well, yeah, it is. But I was reading an article on Insider the other day, and I can't remember who wrote it. You probably know off the top of your head, but it was a stat about throws from 1 to 10 yards, like you were talking about there.
Yeah, KC Joyner. Yeah.
Yeah, KC Joyner. And the thing that really interested me about it is that Justin Blackman was averaging 8.3 yards per attempt, and Ryan Broyles was only averaging 6.3. Did that stat surprise you? Because since Broyles is known as such kind of a possession receiver and Blackman's more of a deep ball threat?
No, not really. I think it comes down to, you know, Broyles just had more attempts. I mean, they looked at him so often in that game. And you have more attempts, your average is probably going to go down. I mean, he's not going to get it, you know, 8, 9, 10 yards every time he touches it. But between him and DeMarco, I think he had something. I think Broyles had something like 60 catches under, you know, 5 yards or something like that. I have to go back and look at that chart. But, I mean, it was a pretty staggering number. And so I think it's just a matter of him getting more chances in short throws. And I think that definitely brought down his total average.
Yeah, and that's kind of just a function of the way OU runs their offense.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. He had 51 receptions on 57 attempts for 345 yards. Under they were thrown at or behind the line of scrimmage.
Wow.
So that's a lot. I mean, he caught 131 passes last year, so he still had 80, you know, I guess you could call it normal catches. I mean, Oklahoma, that offense has worked for them, and those throws are so easy. If you can have some good blocking on the perimeter, it's productive.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, going back to Whedon and Landry Jones, I want to talk about Whedon a little bit. We talked about how consistent he's been, and obviously you get the comparisons to Chris Winkie, and most of that is because of the baseball and because of the age thing. Mm-hmm. Who in the NFL do you see as somebody he kind of compares to pretty well?
You know, I don't really see a whole lot of guys that he just, you know, screams at. You know, obviously not a real athletic guy, but I don't see, you know, I don't see a lot of guys that he looks a whole lot, or I see him and I see a pro guy in him. I think he's kind of his own guy. You know, I think if he kind of looked at it and maybe studied it a little more, you might see some guys jump out at you, but there's no one that really comes to mind for me that I see, and I see a ton of Brandon Whedon in. I think he'll have a good NFL career, but I don't see him comparing to a guy.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Does his career, is he a number two guy on a good team for 5 or 6 years? Does he get the quarterback position on a bad team for a while, or what do you see his career playing out like?
Well, he'll have to find an interesting situation. That's where the age thing is going to be a legitimate issue. You know, I think it's a little bit overstated in the college game. I don't think it matters that much, other than that he's legitimately more mature than the majority of his teammates. But I think he does have to take his age into account when he considers what he wants to do NFL-wise.
Yeah.
And what NFL teams want to do. You know, an NFL team is not going to bring him in and plan to groom him for 3 or 4 years. That doesn't make any sense.
Right.
You know, he's going to get drafted, so it's probably not going to have the luxury of you know, something like a Chase Daniel had, where he wasn't drafted and he could go to a team that kind of fit what he wanted to do. And he ended up with the Saints, which would fit him really well. So he's not going to have that luxury, but I think NFL teams are going to understand what they're drafting. You know, you're going to be getting, he'll be 28 by then. You're going to be getting a 28-year-old guy. If you want him to play, you need him to play, you know, reasonably quickly. You know, maybe 1 or 2 years. But I think you're going to see a team draft him with the intent of playing him pretty quickly. I'd be surprised if you have a team that wants to spend a couple of years grooming him.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think there are other guys on OSU's team that have a future in the NFL. I don't know necessarily these next two guys, but I think they could. And I'm talking about Joseph Randall and Justin Gilbert. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you've written about Gilbert in the past. I have a passion for the way that he plays. I guess we'll call it that. But who do you see having – I mean, obviously, they're going to have very different college careers. But who do you see having a more complete, better college career out of those two guys?
Out of those two, you know, I think probably Gilbert, because he seems more natural for the position. I mean, you look at Randall, we don't really know what he can do running the ball. And there's not a lot of guys in the NFL that have had success, you know, that have come into the league. You know, for one, I think his size leaves a little bit to be desired. But I think there's not a lot of guys that come in, you know, and have success as a running back where your primary goal is a pass catcher. And I still think, you know, obviously he's going to get more carries, but I think the tough yards are probably going to lean a little bit more on Jeremy Smith to go get those.
Yeah.
So he's going to get more carries, but not a ton. And I think whenever the NFL does come around for him, I think there's going to be, you know, a lot of questions on how much you can really rely on him as a running back. I mean, the physical skills are there, but you know, you just kind of have to wait and see how the rest of his career plays out.
Yeah.
Gilbert, I think physically, you know, obviously the speed is there. still has to learn the position. I'm sure he's going to have his own rough nights this year as a first-year starter, at least probably a first-year starter anyway. But it'll be interesting to see kind of, you know, it's really early with those guys. I would have to say probably Gilbert just because, you know, the speed that he does have.
Yeah, and I think
– prototypical size for his position.
Well, I think that with Randall, and obviously it's a long way off, but I think with Randall it really depends on the system that he gets in, whereas I feel like Gilbert could kind of fit in pretty much anywhere.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Just the way that he plays. Okay, you obviously get to cover all the Big 12 games, go to at least one a week. Give me three games you're most excited about covering this year in conference play.
Oh, you got to start. I think you got to start with that Oklahoma State Texas A&M game. That's going to be insane.
Yeah.
You know, Kyle Field at night it's going to be outstanding. I hadn't been there for a night game until the Nebraska game last year, and it was unbelievable. I think they're going to try to do something similar this year with bringing in the amount of student tickets they had. They sold 35,000 student tickets last year.
Wow.
You know, there's a student base of, it's 60,000 student university, but they brought, 35,000. It was unbelievable. And you can definitely tell a huge difference. So that's definitely number one, both, for its stakes. I mean, the winner of that pretty much has the inside track to a probable BCS bowl, the number one challenger to Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
I think number two, probably, people want to talk about that A&M Oklahoma game. I really think that's going to be an underwhelming game. I just don't see A&M going into Norman and winning. I mean, if I had to pick that today, I think Oklahoma wins that game by three touchdowns. You look historically at what they've done when people challenge them in Norman. You know, when somebody does beat Oklahoma in Norman, it's going to be a surpriser. I don't think it's going to be a huge game. Oklahoma just shows up in those games.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll probably pass that one over. But I think, definitely Bedlam at the end of the year. And I'll say A&M in Missouri as the third. It'll be a good one.
And that game's also in College Station, which Missouri came down there last year and just throttled A&M, which I believe was right before Tannehill took.
Yeah, that was Gerard Johnson's penultimate start. He started that game. He started that game, and it was bad. It was as bad as I've seen him play.
Yeah,
and he started again against Kansas the next week, but they made the switch around halftime. I mean, I didn't see that game. But they made the switch around halftime, and Tannehill went off. And then the next week against Tech, they turned it over to Tannehill, and he threw for 449 yards and set a school record. So they were kind of like, I guess this is working. Let's hand it to Tannehill and let him keep going with it. So
yeah, and that was
look back.
That was too bad because, and you probably know this better than me, but it really felt like Dry Johnson was a great leader and a great teammate, and it was just it. You know, you have to feel for that situation because it's just not a good situation for anybody to be in.
Yeah, I feel bad. Yeah, exactly. I mean, he was basically the perfect quarterback, the perfect player, mentally. He's exactly what you wanted. And A&M was really quiet about this until the Cotton Bowl, but I had a chance to talk to their passing game coordinator at the Cotton Bowl. And he basically finally admitted, he had the offseason shoulder surgery, and we got to – he got to camp and he was at about 70% in fall camp. And they said, we'll just keep doing rehab and it'll get stronger. It'll progressively get stronger. And it just didn't, he said,
yeah,
he got to about 80% by the time the season started. And then he kind of got started worn down by the season. They had to rest him during practice. I mean, look at the out route. That's where it was showing up for me was the out routes and deep balls. I mean, you look at the out routes he was throwing against Arkansas and Oklahoma State. I mean, there was nothing on those at all. And I talked to some of the people that covered A&M in 2009, and they said that, on deep balls, Gerard would overthrow guys routinely, four or five times a game even. And they said that the entire, obviously I can't watch every team's every snap, and A&M's first three games last year weren't on TV. But everyone that covered A&M said that Gerard did not overthrow anyone the first five games of the year.
Wow.
And you look at, that interception they threw against Oklahoma State, the one that was legitimately his fault. He had the four interceptions, but a lot of those were just kind of great plays by the defense.
Mm-hmm.
But the one where he had a wide – I don't remember who it was over the middle. I think it might have been Wachiku. He had a wide open – it was a touchdown, and he just reared back to chuck it, and it was just a duck. They went about 30 yards and landed in, I don't know who picked it off, but it was –
I think it was Markel Martin, maybe.
Yeah, probably. It was just ridiculous. It went from a probable touchdown to an easy interception, and that was when it was all right. Because I think that was the Yeah, that was the first time A&M was on TV, so it was the first time I got to see him. I mean, I heard about the four picks against Florida International before they kind of started handing it off, and they ended up coming back and winning that. They were down 21-7 in the fourth quarter of that game and came back and won it 28.
Yeah.
People, that got a little bit overlooked. So he was struggling before that, the Oklahoma State game. But that was the first time I got a chance to see him in 2010, I mean. And it was a little bit jarring. And, you know, it was time. That was what they had to do.
Okay, David, last question. Finish the sentence for me. Oklahoma State will win the Big 12 title in 2011 if...
Oh, gosh. If, if Landry Jones gets hurt. I'd probably have to go with that. You know, I didn't actually talk to Tommy Tuberville about this, but Mark Schlabaugh was over at Big 12 Media Days, and he had lunch with him on, I guess it would have been Monday, and it was Tuesday, and he said basically Tuberville was like, you know what, he's like, nobody's beating Oklahoma this year, so it's not going to happen. I think it's a little bit closer than that, but I think Oklahoma looks like they've, you know, it's going to take them beating themselves for them to lose. I mean, somebody is going to have to just have a terrible night, and it's going to take turnovers or something. I mean, I don't think it's impossible for them to lose to A&M and Oklahoma State, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, I agree. I think that OU is one of these teams that's so deep that even when and if they do make mistakes, whether they're on the road or whatever, that they can overcome them with their talent. Whereas OSU is more one of these teams that they're good. They have a very good team, but they're not deep enough. They have to basically get every break to run the table and to win the Big 12. So if they do, then great. But if, you know, I feel like the percentages obviously lean towards OU winning.
So. Yeah. I would go that way. I think I'd give OU something like a 60-55% chance of winning the league this year.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, I agree with that, but hopefully hopefully things will turn out different in December. Well, David Ubben, Big 12 blogger, appreciate you coming on, talking some Big 12 football, and we will definitely have you on again after the season gets started up.
All right, good to be here. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, David. We'll talk to you later.
Bye.